The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ramesh. Before I jump into a biographical discourse, how many of you have heard me speak here before? Oh, gluttons for punishment. You haven't seen the weather outside? Well, thank you for your company. For those of you who don't know who I am, my name is Ramesh. I'm a psychiatrist by profession, work at United Hospital in St. Paul. I've been practicing here at Common Ground for about 10 years, and Mark has been asking me to give these talks for a couple of years now. I state this at every talk, that I don't sit up here as a teacher. I don't feel qualified to do that. But I feel very qualified to share what I'm experiencing in my practice, mostly challenges. But these talks give me the opportunity to study so as to look somewhat knowledgeable and intelligent when I'm faced with young, eager audiences like you. So how many of you are completely new to practice, meaning you just discovered this kind of meditation just in the last 3-4 months? Okay, so most of you are reasonably familiar. So I'm going back to basics today because I don't know how many of you experienced this, but there are two kinds of practice that we are taught in this system. One is called concentration practice or samadhi practice, and then the other one is insight practice or vipassana. And for those of you who've been doing this practice for a while, I suspect that many of you have gone through these cycles. What should I be doing? Should I do concentration first and then vipassana? Or should I do this or this? Can I do the two separately? And then you find yourself wasting many, many, many hours of sitting practice just trying to figure out what to do and what not to do until you connect to Mark and he gives you some guidance. And so even after 10 years, I find these questions arising, and typically in times when I feel like my practice isn't going well and more like an excuse to stop doing things. And so I found it helpful to ground myself again in what are the basic tenets of concentration practice and vipassana practice, and listen to some teachers, read some articles, and I find every time I've done this, it does energize my practice. And so that's what I want to share with you today. So there are three terms in Pali that you may have heard of. So one is vipassana, one is samadhi, and one is sati. So the English translations or equivalents are vipassana is insight, samadhi is concentration, and sati is mindfulness. And if you listen to folks who are much wiser than me, folks who've done a lot of sutta studies, most of them will say that each of these translations is really quite lousy. And I looked up some of the Sanskrit words, and I would agree. My limited knowledge of Sanskrit does tell me that some of these words are really way off what the original Sanskrit meaning is. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter unless you're a Sanskrit scholar or a Buddhist scholar. When it comes to practice, all we need to know is what do we have to do? And so the one thing we don't want to do is get bogged down into what do these words mean. So hopefully, you will learn what these words mean in English from an Indian. So good luck to you. So vipassana, one simple translation is seeing clearly. And so the whole idea is things are happening in the present moment that we don't see clearly because our minds are clouded with either craving, aversion, or confusion. So we never see what's happening, and we are constantly reacting to what we think is happening based on our misperceptions. And so one of other phrases that are commonly used are seeing with discernment or seeing through the delusion. By the way, this is at the heart of the practice in this tradition, or even with this tradition. The idea of mindfulness meditation is to understand the workings of the mind. But because the mind is so elusive, that it's not always easy to stay with it. So all the other techniques, all the other advice we get are designed to help train our mind so that it can finally stay and watch the processes of the mind and understand the nature of delusion. The second word that I mentioned is sati. By the way, according to the folks who are Buddhist scholars, the word vipassana apparently was hardly ever mentioned by the Buddha. It's something that came on much later and now has come to define a whole tradition. The word he used most often was sati, which is mindfulness. The original meaning was to recollect. And so you can, you know, there are some very nice essays I came across, but one way of looking at it is to recall that the only reality we have is here and now. And so when you find your mind wandering, you don't have to get into the judgment of why it's wandering. The only reality, the only place where you can find any kind of wisdom and learning is what's happening right now. And so that is sati. And the third word is samadhi, and so which is where we'll spend the rest of the evening talking about. So samadhi, the kind of most common translation is concentration. And for some reason, a large number of Buddhist teachers just loathe that word. There is something concentrating about it. There's something narrow, constricting, tightening. But you find a number of words to describe this particular Sanskrit word. So one is one-pointedness or one-pointed focus. The other one is absorption. The other one is calm abiding in the present moment. Another one is centering, coming into the center, or unification of mind. And I'm sure if you do more studies, you'll find more examples. But they all have a center of, they have like, what I sensed was a centripetal force, something that kind of pulls the tendency of the mind towards the center. And so the idea of training in concentration is to give the mind some narrow range in which it can wander around without going off into fantasies and fears. Part of the confusion, especially for those of you who've done your travels around different kinds of Eastern traditions, is that the same word samadhi can mean a lot of things in different traditions, especially if you go into the yogic Hindu tradition. Patanjali Sutras, the samadhi word means something completely different. In fact, when a sage-like person or a saint dies, the phrase in India would be, he has attained samadhi. Now, I'm certainly not intending that any of us die in the process of attaining samadhi, but here it just simply means concentrating and coming to the present moment. So the question then comes up is, you know, what is the role of samadhi in vipassana practice? So it comes up because when you come to a meditation center for the first time, you learn about breath meditation. And soon you find that it's very difficult to practice, it's incredibly boring, and it doesn't really lead to any insights. So you start doubting, you know, what's the point of doing all this? So you read up about it, and then you understand, oh, in order to understand my mind, I need to calm it first. I need to get centered. I need to get concentrated. Yeah, makes sense. But then you more you practice, you realize there's really, it's not something that's achieved very quickly. And then the frustration starts mounting. You know, how long do I have to keep doing this before I gain some wisdom? And then you hear someone say, you know, you really don't need concentration. You really need to watch the workings of your mind. You know, get curious about your mind. You don't have to focus on one thing. Just focus on whatever arises in the moment. Well, guess what? It's like giving a teenager permission to live life the way they want to. But they do everything. And our mind is a teenager. And so it goes off here, 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 here. And before long you conclude, you know, I need to have some concentration practice before I can do vipassana. And that's where I am 10 years down the line. But along the way, you find that whether you've been doing one or the other, what's really kind of given me confidence is that even though I've been kind of bouncing around and sometimes doing neither, with each passing year, I find both concentration practice and insight practice just getting that much easier. So even an inefficient way of doing this, so long as you stick with it, you will find results as you go along in the years. But there are some very definite inherent benefits to samadhi practice. So that's why this technique is commonly used in traditions outside of any kind of meditation or Buddhism. If you never came to Common Ground but just decided, I'm going to practice one-pointed focusing every day for 15 minutes, you will have incredible benefits in your daily life. You may not be any wiser, but you will have benefits. So one thing that is known, that a restless mind is an incredibly energy-consuming mind. Thought process thinking is very energy inefficient, but also it needs a lot of energy. So if you have a very busy day filled with thoughts, you will feel tired in your body. The problem with modern-day living is many of our thoughts are related to imaginary fears that never actually take place or will take place. And fears and anxieties also release a lot of, you know, they cause autonomic arousal. They cause all kinds of adrenaline and bad hormones to get jettisoned around your bloodstream, and you have to use energy to quell them. So one very definite benefit of concentration practice, it just calms down your autonomic nervous system, slows down your breathing, reduces your blood pressure. And so even if you are really not looking for wisdom, there are some definite benefits to concentration practice. So I would say that for those of you having some difficulty either understanding the concept of insight, or just your lives are so busy that it doesn't permit that kind of dedication to insight practice, don't give up on just the basic tenets of concentration practice. And there are some, you know, there are the good kinds of concentration itself is spiritually neutral. Okay, so if you use concentration practice to further, you know, contemplation and insight, you would call it spiritually wholesome. If you use concentration practice so that you become good at video games, or become a good chess player, or you become more efficient and productive at work, that's spiritually, it's a good thing, but it's not wholesome. So that would be spiritually neutral. But if you want to train your concentration to become so quiet, so stealthy that you can pickpocket or go steal somebody's, you know, break into someone's house, that would be spiritually unwholesome. So the point here is that concentration practice by itself is just a technique. It's just another habit. It's a training of the mind. It doesn't mean that it automatically leads to anything wholesome. And if you heard interview with folks like Tiger Woods or basketball players who trained with Phil Jackson at Chicago Bulls, they learned concentration practice. And so, you know, it's the final 2 seconds of a championship game, the Chicago Bulls, and the rest of us, is the whole, we get caught up in the stories. Championship game, if I get the ball and I miss the basket, then, you know, my team's going to be pissed off, my fans are going to be pissed off. But all these stories have no connection to the act of receiving the ball, aiming, and shooting. So many of these players do go through intensive concentration practice to train themselves to focus on the one-pointed activity, which is hear the buzzer, receive the ball, aim, and shoot. Whereas the mere mortals like us will clearly, you know, flub it because we get caught up in the stories. So there are some benefits. But I'll jump to what I find is the most beneficial benefit of this practice, which is cultivation of patience. And it's been especially helpful for me because I'm an incredibly impatient man, and it just comes to fore when I'm in trying to concentrate. And just once I've determined that for the next 20 minutes, all I'm going to do is listen to the ticking of the clock or stay with the pressure sensation in my butt, it requires patience for me not to get up and stop the meditation halfway. And over the years, that's one thing I've really found very helpful is that, you know, if I try to practice patience elsewhere, say if I'm driving, even after all these years, I get impatient with drivers. But with this practice, I found this technique, because I've committed myself to sitting in one place and to doing this practice, regardless of how stupid I think it is, the one fringe benefit I found is it has really helped develop this concept of patience. The second benefit that I heard from others, which I've not yet found in myself, is it allows people to be gentle and kind to themselves. They recognize how vulnerable we are. I mean, how grandiose we can get about our abilities. And so the only way you can allow yourself to stay with this fragile, this kind of this fallible mind is by being kind to yourself. That's the concept of training a puppy. For me, I find gritted patience is easier to develop than being kind to myself, because every time I find my mind wandering, the thought "You're so stupid" keeps coming very quickly. But someday, I hope in a few years, if I keep practicing, I'll find some kindness and say, "You know, you're a flawed human being and your mind keeps wandering." Then coming from the neuroscience background, this is the core of neuroplasticity. You know, those of you who read books about mindfulness, meditation, and science, the science perspective is that the brain is an incredibly plastic organ. So what we used to think was a rigid, fixed circuitry, now we know is incredibly flexible, and so we can train it in all kinds of ways. So our modern-day life trains us to be distracted, trains us to check our cell phone, email, internet, telephone, and whatever else. And so this is a way, at least in brief moments, to train yourself not to respond to those distracting habits. And so the more often you do it, the more likely that these rewirings will take place. And it's only with time that you'll know. So 2 years after practice, you'll suddenly wake up one day and realize that, you know, 2 years earlier, I would have responded to this situation very differently. And that's what will give you the boost to keep with the practice. So I'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about the next topics because I'm not a Buddhist scholar. I've not done much sutta studies. But since I'm giving a Dharma talk, I feel I should mention a few dharmic stuff. So apparently the word samadhi shows up in more or less than most of the other faculties that they talk about, that the Buddha talked about. So it has its own component in the Noble Eightfold Path. So you have your sila, samadhi, and your punya. So the samadhi, there's a whole, and there are three components to it. So the Buddha decided to give a significant attention to concentration as a wholesome practice in his Eightfold Path. It's also one of the five spiritual faculties, essential component. So you have faith, you have energy, you have concentration, mindfulness, leading to wisdom. And then it's also one of the seven factors of awakening. If you delve deep into Theravadin or the Vipassana literature, you'll hear all kinds of discourses and all kinds of debates about jhanas, the levels of jhanas, the levels of concentration. As far as I'm concerned, if I can get my mind to stay still for 1 minute, I've made it to the 10th jhana. But for those of you who like jhana stuff, go ahead and read it, but it's interesting. Then there are four kinds of samadhi, and I'm just going to talk about one, because this is key to what anchors samadhi to vipassana practice. So there are many teachers, and including one that I really respect nowadays, Saida Uttejaniya. They really believe that you can get bogged down if you're really sincere about committing to insight practice, understanding your mind. You want to use samadhi as a tool, but don't get too bogged down into samadhi. Because, as I said earlier, you can get really concentrated but be unaware. Samadhi is, after all, it is a narrowing practice. It is a concentrating practice. It is not opening. It is not watching everything that's going on. It's kind of training the mind to stay with one thing. So there's one kind of samadhi called momentary concentration. So this is the concentration of say, for example, like as I was guiding you during the meditation and you find yourself wandering, you didn't find yourself wandering for a minute. You found yourself wandering for that flash of a second when you recognized that you were wandering. Until then, you were wandering. You were not present. So that moment when you recognize, that is a moment of mindfulness. But that is a moment of mindfulness brought about by concentration. That's a momentary concentration. So many teachers would say that so long as you train yourself to have series of momentary concentrations, you don't really need to have a dedicated concentration practice. And I'll talk about how Uttejaniya describes it. Some teachers also talk about you really don't need to separate this and this. You can start off with saying, you know, I'm going to train my mind to come back to the anchor. But I'll also recognize that every time I find my mind wandering, I'll recognize, there was a moment of awareness that my mind was wandering. And if you get into a slightly deeper levels of practice, you can then also stay in that awareness to see what was the feeling tone of that fantasy. Say, for example, I have a meeting tomorrow that's been kind of churning me up. So I'm trying to breathe, and then my mind has gone off to tomorrow. And I'm really marinating in that meeting until I suddenly realize, oh, I was at the meeting. But if I'm practicing both concentration and vipassana, I could stay just for a few seconds after I realized that I was marinating in tomorrow's meeting and come back to the feeling tone. What does it feel to be anxious? What does it feel to be stressful? What does it feel to be fearful? But just for a few seconds and then come back to your anchor. So then you're training the concentration, but also connecting with moment by moment activities of your mind. Is this making, this is the kind of halfway point, so I want to check. Is this making sense? Is this flow reasonably okay? Thanks. And then there are three other, there's momentary concentration, preliminary concentration, access concentration, absorption concentration. There is a great website called Access to Insight. It has all kinds of articles about all kinds of sutras by wonderful teachers, so you can go ahead and enjoy that. So let's come to the practical aspect of samadhi practice. So I'm going to come back to, say you devote yourself to at least part of your practice to cultivating a one-pointedness of concentration. And I do that every day. So my practice in the morning is 15 minutes. I go to my study. I get into a kind of lying down position. I spend about 3-4 minutes letting gravity settle my body. And then I have a ticking clock. And then I just set my timer for 15 minutes. And I just keep listening to the ticking clock. Breath doesn't work for me. I've tried it 10, 15 years. It always seems to tighten up. So something outside has worked well for years. And I notice now the value of doing it every day, because I wake up on a Monday morning and it's hell, and I do this and it's semi-hell by the time I go to work. Am I allowed to say hell at a meditation center? Forgive me. But the value is so intense, because I noticed if I just jumped out of bed, you know, the mind's already planning for the clinic, meetings, blah, blah, blah. The way I shave, the way I brush my teeth, the way I inhale my breakfast, you know, none of that's necessary. Somehow the 45 minutes of getting ready seems to get compressed into 15 minutes of tension. And so that 15 minutes has really helped me. But you can pick whatever works for you. And many of these techniques were suggested by the Buddha. So you can use, the most common suggestion is the breath, because it's with you all the time, it's portable, you can take it anywhere, any situation. So if it works for you, you can use the breath. And again, as I mentioned at the guided meditation, don't get fixated on one particular anchor. On a busy day, you need a lot of space to allow your mind to ricochet around. But on a Sunday morning, after you've had a relaxing Saturday, you may be able to come down to the sensation of the breath going in and out of your nostril. So it's not about what you're concentrating on. It's about the process of bringing the mind back to the present. So if you choose the breath, you can use here. You can use rising and falling, or the general sensation of, you know, the body itself has a breathing movement, if you get subtle into that. Visual. People look at a flame is a common example. Some people look at, you know, various shapes that are soothing and calming. Sounds, I mentioned, I use the ticking clock. Noting practice or counting practice seems to be particularly helpful. Again, it is, there's no awareness or wisdom. You just are using a secondary anchor to connect you to the primary anchor. So if you decide to use your breath, then you can start off with 10, meaning inhalation, exhalation, 10, inhalation, exhalation, 9, inhalation, exhalation, 8. The reason you don't want to start with 1, 2, 3, 4 is you can go on autopilot. You can count on one channel, breathe on one channel, and fantasize on the third channel. But the 10, 9, 8, or 100, 99, 98 really grounds you to that counting. And don't cheat. Each number has to be inhalation, exhalation. And if you find yourself wandering, go back to 100. So punishment also works. And so that's why it's not an inside practice. It's crude. But there are times when you need to tighten up. Chanting. For those of you who, you know, whether saying prayers or you come to the chanting sessions here on Sundays, that's comforting. You can do it. Doesn't work for me. Having grown up in India and grown up among bhajans, I have an aversive conditioning to that. Then the four Brahma Viharas that you may have heard of, loving kindness, generosity, gratitude, no? Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Sympathetic joy, not something that comes easily. Schadenfreude, on the other hand, is very easy. Unfortunately, it's not a wholesome concentration practice. These are, you know, hard practices, but at its core, they are concentration practices. And so repetitive chanting, but the added benefit is they really open the heart in a way that the other kinds of concentration practices don't. I've struggled with them, so as a guy, compassion, not much of my forte, so I like more the mechanical stuff. But those of you who are able to open your heart and cultivate some of these Brahma Viharas, you really can get double bonuses. And then I'll touch upon Sayadaw Utejaniya's concept of how he describes concentration. So he's a contemporary Burmese teacher. He's come here a lot. Mark has done retreats with him. And his retreats are very unique. Talking is allowed, and there are no structure. There's no walking, sitting. You walk and you sit, but not in any particular schedule. Because his point is that we create artificial boundaries between this time is meditation, this time is sitting, this time is walking, this time is concentration, this time is brushing my teeth. His idea of meditation practice is all about wisdom and understanding the mind. And so his point is that you have to create an awareness of what's happening. Every time we reach out to an object of concentration, we are shutting down everything else. So his point is that you create, so the example he gives at one of the talks is, he tells everyone, you know, place your hands together. And say, when did you become aware that your hands were touching each other? And most folks will say, when you asked us, when did you become aware? And then he says, yeah, that's right. It's when you bring your attention here, that's when you become aware. That is concentration. And the reason he gives this example is to point out how little effort it took to bring the attention here. Oh, I'm aware of it. So if my mind then decides I want to be aware of this gentleman's face, so long as I'm following it, I am still maintaining my awareness. And then my mind goes here, I'm maintaining awareness. So I get his point, and in situations of retreat after the third or fourth day, I get that. But in daily life, it's a huge struggle. For me, when my mind goes from here to a story, my mind, my awareness doesn't follow it. I'm in the story for a few minutes and then I become aware. But I get his point that if we are truly practicing moment by moment awareness, at some point we have to slowly surface to not being concerned about the object of concentration and more about the awareness itself. So he has a number of booklets and talks. They're all free PDF files. So if you're interested, you can study him. But sometimes it can get a little too abstract and frustrating. During those moments, I come back to the body and come back to concentration practice. So just some guidelines about how you could do this in daily life. And my personal bias, as I mentioned earlier, is that even if you're not really, if you don't find yourself in a place where you can devote a lot of time for insight practice and wisdom, at a very basic physical mental health level, it's good for all of us to have a small 10-15 minute concentration practice. So you don't hurt yourself in any way, but also don't con yourself into believing that I am you know, I'm looking for wisdom. You know, where is the wisdom? Why am I not getting better? Why don't I understand myself? You can't understand yourself by narrowing your focus. But by itself, it's a healthy practice. It's much better than drifting into internet or the television. So, like with, you know, other advice you've heard from teachers about practice, this is a daily practice. And the other thing is, like neuroplasticity, think of playing a piano. Would you beat yourself up or would you beat your kid up for not playing a, you know, piano sonata after a week of practice? But somehow when it comes to the mind, this most intricate organ, we somehow think it's the, you know, the easiest thing to do. And so just like piano or any other skill to be learned, if you're just practicing concentration practice, your job is just to do. Keep doing it, and one day you will see the change. Have you heard that, you know, have you heard of a teacher called Joko Beck? Some of you may have heard. She died a couple of years ago. She was a Zen teacher in San Diego. And so she gives this wonderful story. So she was a trained concert pianist, or she was, and she was at a conservatory. And she, after much application, she got connected to a teacher who was known for his incredible teaching skills. And so the first day he gives her a particular, you know, I don't know what you call it, but a string of musical notations to play. And so he plays it for her, and then she plays it just like he played. And he says, no, play again. And so as you can imagine, it's day after day after day, the same thing, play again, play again. And she's, of course, you know, frustrated, angry, crying, distraught, but can't give up. And then one fine day, he says, good, you played well. And then she bursts into tears and she says, what did I do different? And he said, well, you learned to listen. Anyone can play, but not everyone can listen. I think that's what Utejaniya is saying, is that we mistake awareness of what's happening for focusing on what's happening. And that's why concentration feels so effortful. It feels tight because we think we have to force our minds to be with that object. And so all the teachers will say concentration actually is pulling back and being aware. And it should not be effortful. And so long as people keep trying, whether it's piano or tennis, the skill is in not trying but just doing the flow that they talk about. So this part I'm just preaching. I'm practicing. Maybe someday I'll get into the flow. By the way, flow does happen if you're in a retreat setting. I mean, that I can say for certain. By the third day or fourth day of a retreat, I can watch thoughts just coming up in slow motion and I can bat them away. Things that I never believed. But then, of course, you come out of that and you hit the first traffic light and boom, it's all gone. I am cussing, I'm tightened up. So, and that's why the Buddha, so, you know, concentration practice was deep and, you know, well-established in India for thousands of years before the Buddha came around. His first few teachers taught him to get to extremely deep levels of concentration. What he discovered was, as soon as he opened his eyes, he was back to square one. So that's why he realized that anything conditioned is not the final answer. So when I come out of the retreat, I'm back to being my jackass self. So again, daily practice, consistency of practice, not looking for outcome. So it's just doing it, and one day you learn to listen. And in this case, one day we'll learn to become aware. Setbacks, and many teachers would tell you that on the days you find your mind wandering, you know, every 5-6 seconds, that's actually a good day, because every 5-6 seconds, you recognize you're wandering and you come back. You recognize you're wandering. So every 5-6 seconds, you have a momentary concentration and awareness. Whereas on a day when you're really chilled out and you're just sitting with your butt or, you know, your breath, well, you're not really doing much mindfulness. You're really enjoying the sense of stillness and calm, which is a good outcome of concentration, but doesn't lead to much wisdom. So a bad concentration sit is actually a good concentration sit. But you know that these adjectives really have no meaning. And repetitive brief sessions are much better than single long sessions. So I do in the morning 15 minutes, then I do before I go from hospital to the clinic, before I have lunch, I do another 15 minutes. And then when I come home from work, I do 15 minutes, and then I do my evening sit. I'm showing off here. This happens about, 3 days a week. But still there's a momentum. But I do the morning and I do some of the others on most days. But break it down. So if you can do five, I told you it's a support group, so I'm just sharing. So again, set the intention and then break it into manageable portions and you'll see a lot of benefit. And watch for the sense of tightness. Many of us have succeeded in life because of our goal-directedness. You know, wanted to get through med school, I put in the effort, you get through. Residency, same thing. Everything is a target, a goal, a strategy, a plan of action, and da-da-da, you get through. Unfortunately, we bring the same to meditation practice, and here it becomes this forceful, gritty determination. And at the end of a concentration practice, when you're forcing your restless mind to do something, it actually leaves you feeling tired. So when you recognize that, have some other techniques, whether it's watching the flame, listening to something, and I forgot my favorite, walking meditation. So on busy days, or when you have a lot of energy in your body, the best way to walk off the energy and then also relax your muscles and have a nice concentration practice is walking meditation. For those of you not familiar with it, just Google walking meditation and you'll get some very nice instructions. Common Ground website also has instructions. And then, as I mentioned, have a broad sense of what one-pointedness means. One-pointedness can be this, as in coming to your nose, but it can also be the chest, it can be the body. Or as I mentioned, there was a couple of days when I came here for a day-long retreat. For the first couple of sits, all I could do was sit here with my eyes open and just connect to this space. Because I really have some really warm feelings for this space, and then Mark's here, and then the folks sharing the retreat, and that helps me settle down. That I learned from hard practice during previous retreats when I would sit and try to settle down. And you end up sleeping, or you end up tightening, increasing your pain. So that's when I discovered that just be kind, just open up. And I think this is big enough space for the most restless mind to find some solace in. I'll end with a few points about cautions and some of the pitfalls of samadhi practice. I mentioned some of those, but sometimes, especially those of you who are good at concentration practice, you can very quickly attain states of stillness and calm and mistake that for the goal of meditation, and that can often become addicting. And that's one of the reasons some of us who do retreats plan for the next retreat while we are in the middle of a retreat. Having a good time, this is pretty cool. You know, no drugs, nothing, and I'm feeling pretty relaxed. Let me plan the next retreat. There's no wisdom there. So nothing wrong in doing concentration practice, but recognize the craving for that kind of relaxation, the stillness. And as I mentioned, those of you with the tendency to goal-directedness, achievement, and a target, you can really make it a linear process as opposed to an open, receptive being with the present moment. Suzuki Roshi apparently said that meditating to achieve samadhi is like sightseeing practice. It's like you're really not interested in understanding the story or the history or the culture of a place. You're just kind of, grazing past. So you just sit on a bus and go through Rome and you come back and tell people all about Roman culture and, everything else without having really experienced it, but you've seen it from a distance. So we've become, like me, good at talking about it, but not experiencing it. And then those of you with a tendency to be self-critical, who need your yardsticks, your measures, especially if you are comparing yourself with others, you can start coming up with stories of that person looks really concentrated and relaxed and I'm not. And then you start setting up artificial guideposts, signposts to what you need to achieve. And if you don't, then you become too self-critical, tight. More importantly, that becomes an excuse to stop practicing altogether. So even as you're doing your concentration practice, maintain the awareness of what you're doing and why you're doing. Because even if you're not really doing fancy vipassana insight, that little awareness will prevent you from going down the path of the grittedness, tightness, and confusing stillness for wisdom. And I was really happy to hear many experienced teachers, including Gil Fronsdal in California, say that they've been practicing for 25 years. Some of them went to Burma to learn from Sayadaw Upandita, and who was a taskmaster for concentration practice. And even after years, they could never get anything close to a decent concentrated state. But that proves the point that you don't need concentrated state to have wisdom and awareness. And so if my mind is not wired for those deep states of jhana, so acknowledge that, practice it because it does help, but don't set any artificial expectations. Now, I'll end with this quote from, there's a monk called Anilayo, and his most famous book, for those of you who really want to get into deeper study, is his treatise on the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is from the text. The advantages of developing absorption concentration are not only that it provides a stable and receptive state of mind for the practice of insight and meditation. The experience of absorption, and here he means by absorption, he means samadhi. The experience of absorption is one of intense pleasure and happiness brought about by purely mental means, which thereby automatically eclipses any pleasure arising in dependence on material objects. Thus, absorption functions as a powerful antidote to sensual desires by divesting them of their former attraction. I will open to questions. We have about 10, 12 minutes. And again, the guidance that the teachers would have, and I believe it, is that it's less about the object, it's about your awareness. So getting hung up on, am I focusing on the object, gets you away from, number one, being aware of why your mind is fixated on focusing on one object, but in the meantime, while you're questioning, you're not focusing on what's right in front of you. So it's that letting go. This is a strange practice of practicing of not being a big deal. And so the way I can give you some personal examples. And so the way I learned about keeping my eyes open, and those of you who come to my pain workshop have heard this story already, so feel free to doze off. But I have back pain. And so 2013 to 14, I went through a phase of fairly chronic exacerbation where I couldn't sit for more than 10 minutes at a time. And I had to resort to lying down practice. And guess what happens? You lie down and you go to sleep. And by the way, so I'm digressing a little bit. You lie down, you go to sleep, deep sleep, and you wake up and you say, I may as well go to bed and sleep. You go to bed and then you can't sleep. So there is the connection. The mind can decide to sleep when it decides meditation is boring, but when it's in the bed, maybe it can watch TV or read. So I had to learn to keep my eyes open. So all those years before that, idea of meditation was keep your eyes closed. Even though with my eyes closed, there were many days, as soon as I closed my eyes, my mind would go off. And the only way I could stop my mind from wandering was to open my eyes. But then if I opened my eyes, it was always looking for something to focus on. So when I lay down and I had to train myself, and suddenly I became aware of space. And then I read a talk by Ajahn Sumedho, where he talks about he was talking about awareness, and he talks about how common it is for us to, when we look at space, we look at certain points here and there without being awareness of the space in between. And I was reminded of a person who had come to a pain workshop who had migraine headaches, and they would really trouble her. And then at one day she said, it struck me that the throbbing headache, there's pain, and then there's a gap, and then there's pain. And then it struck her that 50% of the time she's pain-free. It's only 50% of the time that she's in pain. That insight was amazing for her. And literally, can't say it certainly, but her pain probably went down by 40 to 50%, just that insight. Same way here is this awareness of space. What am I missing while focusing on that scones or faces of people? So as I lay down in my study, looking around, I realized what a different perspective that I never ever see. And it's actually quite stimulating. And then I would come here to do lying practice, and you get a completely different perspective. So that becomes the key to any concentration practice is curiosity. The reason my mind went to sleep when I lay down was there was no curiosity. Now I gave it something to do. So same with vision. If you choose to do a flame, be curious about the dynamic nature of the flame, not as a static object to be watched. And that's why the Burmese teachers, when they talk about breath, it's not the concept of breath, but it's the living experience of the sensation of breathing. And I swear, even though I listen to a quartz clock in the study, every other ticking has a different sound. It could be my mind, but it keeps me curious about why does this sound different? Some days, of course, I get caught up in the story of why does this sound different. But my short response or long response to your quick question is be curious. Not get caught into, is it soft awareness? Is it firm awareness? Try both. On a sleepy day, you will know what soft awareness means. Because on retreats, that's what I would do. I just open my eyes and look at this pattern. Then I would realize that I'm focusing on the pattern. And then you go into kind of semi-sleepy kind of state. You're not asleep, but you're unfocused. And that's what I do when I'm doing walking meditation at home. I come home from a busy day at work. Either I'm pounding or I have to sometimes close my eyes. So I then combine soft pedaling with eyes partly closed so I don't see anything except the kind of light around so I don't crash into walls. But experiment with curiosity. What you're focusing on really doesn't matter.
Hi, my name is Don. And thank you for all of that because it felt on one way to, it gave my thinking permission. I have a lot of thoughts on these where I've gotten there just a little bit. I've been practicing since in October, and it's really good to know that those thoughts are out there and that it's just not all craziness that's going on. And
don't use that word with a psychiatrist. Don't hear that.
And when you said I think I've had that experience. I do a 30 minute morning meditation walk at 6 o'clock in the morning in my backyard, and I have these just days. It's been interesting to see where it's been and going. It feels like it's been getting worse, but I have these breakthroughs. And today I did have this thought where you said where you were tossing up a thought and then you could just see it come and land. What happened with me on that is all of a sudden I had that and then I lost it and I said, well, how do I get that back? And then I could feel I tightened up. I said, you know, don't forget about it because I knew right away I was getting tight. The other thing that happened though, and this is where I'm still trying to, I guess, piece it together. It just happened this morning. But I had, I think it was kind of like an out of body experience. And then I'm like, can I do that? Can I say, this body is like this. This is what is happening. And it felt like I was, and I didn't know if I could kind of give myself permission. And then I got kind of scared because I'm like going, well, who's driving this? You know, it's like the body snatchers, like I inhabited this body. And I was like, oh, I can't, like, that's not right. You know? So that was kind of weird. I don't know really where to go with that.
So again, I'm not a Buddhist scholar, but I think there were the four imponderables. I think so. The Buddha apparently said that there are four questions that it's not worthwhile pondering about. And I think one is about question of time or philosophical stuff. But one of the things that he said was the powers that can be attained from concentration practice. And again, whether it's myth or whether you believe or not, apparently amazing powers, amazing experiences are possible at different levels of jhana. But all the teachers repeatedly say they are just passing scenery. And sometimes they can be scary, but that's where awareness is necessary. And that's where I believe that you can't just have concentration practice, because if you have just concentration practice without awareness of what you're doing, you can get dissociated. Now I'm getting into psychological. So you can have a dissociated experience. That was a very minor form of that. So you could come back quickly, but that's why jhana practice can also become addictive. And you hear stories of levitation, flying, or whatever. Whether they are possible or not, the Buddha, his point of saying this was they are imponderables. Don't go down that path. Experience whatever arises, but it's just what it is. It's whatever is happening in the present moment. So,
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.